dependence on Shraddha, on trust. So one definition of Shraddha is it's a faculty. It's a kind of capacity that we all have, a faculty for responding to the truth or to value. And this operates at all sorts of levels. It operates on a constant, almost constantly, right through the day, on a very mundane level. It's our responsiveness to the environment is going on all the time. We were looking at this in our group in the Know Your Mind study webinars. We were looking at the constants of minds, and they're just about responsiveness to our environment. So that contact, hedonic feeling, recognition, will, and attention. Okay, to give an example, I really enjoyed my blueberries this morning for breakfast, and so I had the taste of the blueberry, that contact, and then the hedonic feeling. Oh, I like blueberries. I enjoy the taste and the texture. And then I kind of, there's recognition, interpretation. I bring extra layers in. Not only do I see their blueberries, but I know blueberries have antioxidants, and I haven't had a cold in the 2 years that I've been having blueberries every morning for breakfast. I haven't had a bad cold. So all this information kind of is coming in, interpretation. And then there's an act of will on my part. You know, if I see the blueberries are running low, I'll put them on my shopping list. I don't want to run out. So there's an act of will. And say if Morrison's doesn't have blueberries, well, you know, I persevere. My attention stays on getting the blueberries. I'm determined because I like them so much. So I'll go to Sainsbury's and I'll keep on trying until I find blueberries. So that's just an example of the mundane expression of our ability to respond to what we value in our environment. But of course, we're more interested now in looking at a capacity to respond to, if you like, higher values or guiding truths, ethical ideals, or maybe beauty in our lives. And Buddhism would say we have this intuitive capacity to respond. An intuitive sense of there's more to life than simply the material, day-to-day, mundane. And there's some sort of instinct that we have for what is ethical, meaningful, and true. There's an automatic almost attraction for these values. It's like we have antennae that start vibrating when we come across the good, the meaningful, the true. There's this story of Anathapindika, who became the Buddha's greatest patron. He was a merchant and a banker in travesty, but he was on this business trip. That's in North India, a bit further north of where the Buddha was at the time, at Rajagraha. But he went on a business trip to Rajagraha, where the Buddha and his monks were all settled. And he was talking with his brother-in-law, who was also a banker. And his brother-in-law just mentioned in passing the word Buddha, which means enlightened, the enlightened one. And Anathapindika just, what did you say, Buddha? And Anathapindika said, yeah, his brother-in-law said, yeah, Buddha. And Anathapindika asked him three times, did you say Buddha? It's like this word had some resonant significance for him that it just left him kind of intrigued and puzzled and attracted. And then he said, I want to meet this man, this word, but the enlightened one, Buddha. This is something quite special. I want to meet him now. And his brother said, look, you can't just meet the Buddha just like that. You know, we'd have to organize it. Oh, I want to see him. The brother-in-law said, look, we'll sort it in the morning. So, you know, just don't worry about it. We'll sort it in the morning. So Anathapindika goes to bed. And three times, the scripture said that three times during the night, he wakes up thinking it's dawn. He's so expectant. He's so looking to, he has such a strong sort of, his antennae are going so strongly around this being of the Buddha. So this kind of, this faculty that we have is intrinsic to our human consciousness, Buddhism would say. It's our inheritance. It comes with the package of being conscious human beings. And it's based in this, what Sangharaksha describes as the ultimate in us resonating with the ultimate in the universe. So the ultimate in us resonating with the ultimate in the universe. So this suggests that we have something special within us. And I referred to this last night when I mentioned Buddhahood. You know, Buddhism has this very optimistic take on our humanity and on our reason, on our consciousness, our human consciousness, that deep down there's this level, this if you like, a metaphor, a beautiful combination of metaphors, is the jewel and the lotus. Deep down at our core, we have this jewel, which is priceless, which is pure, which is self-luminous consciousness, self-luminous awareness. And this is at the root of our capacity to respond to value. There's a sutra called the Ratnagotra Vibhaga Sutta, and it says, if the element of the Buddha did not exist in everyone, there could be no disgust with suffering, nor could there be a wish for nirvana, nor striving for it, nor a resolve to win it. So it's like there's something in us that is echoed out in the world, something precious. So and out of that place within us comes an inner call when we come across the truth, the beauty. And that represents the beginning, that call, if you like, that little voice is the beginning of a journey. And that is Shraddha. And it's sometimes described as a kind of a foreshadowing of insight. It's a taste or a presentment of right vision. I don't know if you're familiar with the Eightfold Noble Path, but the start of the Eightfold Noble Path is right vision, this sense of an intuitive grasp of truth. So Shraddha takes us onto a trajectory towards wisdom. And it's the whole of the spiritual life, the whole of the Eightfold Noble Path really is part of that trajectory of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. So it's an intuitive response. Shraddha is an intuitive response to value, to the good, the beautiful. And it's a total response. It engages the whole of our being. There's one definition of mindfulness, which is borrowing from D.H. Lawrence. It's the mindfulness is the whole of us wholly attending. Well, Shraddha is the whole of us wholly responding. It's like all aspects of our mind, heart. So Buddhism uses this word citta, and Pranayanita mentioned last night. And citta, the best translation is not mind. It's more. It also includes that affective aspect of ourselves. So it's mind, heart is a better translation of citta. So Shraddha engages all aspects of ourselves. And I just want to give you a slide which will hopefully illustrate the different aspects, so that there are three aspects of our being that are addressed by Shraddha. The first, they are, in one way of putting it, they are the head, the heart, and the legs aspects of us as human beings. The head is the cognitive aspect, and there's a name given to this, which is deep faith. So the head part, the cognitive part, the knowing part is described as deep faith. And Xuang Sang, I'm sure Pranayanita knows a bit of Chinese, so she probably knows the pronunciation of this name, Xuan Sang. I'm calling him Xuang Sang out of my ignorance. So the objects of deep faith, what deep faith responds to are realities, truths, are embodiments of truth. And this, as I was saying earlier, includes the mundane. But of course, we're focusing more on the dharmic ourselves. You know, dharmic truths like the precepts, or and the fact, for perhaps this fascinates me anyway, that the first precept really includes all the precepts. The Abhidharma that we've been working with and exploring in the webinars, well, its description of the structure of mind with the constants and the intensifiers, I find so it's rational, it's cohesive, it's compelling in that regard. So I have a rational response to that. Like, in a sense, I can't unknow it. Say if I do learn some uncomfortable truths, I can't unknow those truths. So this the fact that these truths are consistent with my rational sense of myself, that gives me confidence and trust. So that's at the beginning, a foundation of this sense of confidence, trust in the truth. Now, there may be some element of belief in our knowing. So belief is a kind of knowing. I'm raising the issue of belief because faith is one of the translations of Shraddha, and I think it's necessary to look at this sense of the notion of at least a blind faith. And now the faith, the Shraddha that we're talking about is certainly not blind faith. We you know, belief is necessary. It makes our life functional because, you know, on a mundane level, we depend on evidence of dependability. So, you know, people maybe, in order to depend on them, we listen to them and we check out whether what they're saying is right. And then afterwards we know, they were right last time, that I did well by them last time, I'll do so again. We can't research all the information that we get. We have to trust, you know, whether it's a book, an author, a newspaper, a report on the internet. Through our experience, we develop confidence, trust. We develop belief on the basis of the person who said it. But it's a rational belief. It's not blind faith. It's not blind belief. So one of the definitions of blind belief, which may be there in some traditions, faith traditions, is it's an acceptance of truths on authority which have not been demonstrated or proved or backed up by previous experience. So that's not what cognitive faith is in Buddhism. It's not blind faith. So that I've been looking there at that first aspect of faith, the head aspect, the cognitive. The second is the affective aspect. This is described as lucid faith. It's a movement of the heart, basically. The Sanskrit Shraddha actually means to place the heart on. Sangharacitta uses some descriptions. He describes faith, this aspect of faith, as a spontaneous emotional response to spiritual truth. So it's a spontaneous emotional response. He also calls it a heartfelt response to the spiritually attractive. And also a third quote, a response of delight and fascination on encountering the truth. So a response of delight and fascination. So truth is attractive. There's kind of an aesthetic quality to truth that we can appreciate. Sometimes it's an inspiring truth. Sometimes it's actually beautiful. It's in its simplicity, perhaps. Our hearts lift. I do like that Latin phrase, sursum corda. We lift up our hearts to the truth, to that which we find of value. Sursum corda. So it's a movement of the heart, is Shraddha, towards what has of value. And of course, for Buddhists, what is of highest value for us are the three jewels. So we take delight in the three jewels. Our hearts are lifted, they are expanded, they smile, our hearts smile when they encounter the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. They are a source of joy. Another quote from Sangharacitta, so that this aspect of faith is a deep enjoyment of the contemplation of the ideal, a deep enjoyment of the contemplation of the ideal. Nagarjuna, the fourth century philosopher writer, he described faith as the quintessence of the means of happiness. So our hearts are gladdened by the faith in the three jewels. That starts, of course, with the Buddha. And one way you could describe the whole Buddhist path, Sangharakshita does this, he describes it as rejoicing in the Buddhist achievement, the Buddha's achievement. He had this experience of coming back from India after 20 years in India to London, and he went to a meeting of Buddhists, and they had a ritual. It was Wesak Day, I think it was a festival. And he looked around and he thought, everybody's looking very glum. Are people not celebrating the fact that the Buddha achieved enlightenment on this day? Why are people so glum? So, you know, he was emphasizing the fact that the Buddhist life is a life of joy. It's a life of rejoicing in the Buddha's achievement. Every now and again, when I'm more aware and I look at an image of the Buddha, I think of that phrase that the Buddha uses himself to describe his experience of enlightenment. He says, "House builder, you have now been seen. You shall not build this house again. The rafters have been broken down. The ridgepole is demolished too." He's expressing the fact that, you know, he's seen through this, the ego. He's not identified. So for me, when I see an image, something in me jumps for joy in contemplation of that possibility. The doors to the deathless have been opened, as I mentioned last night. The Buddha describes that as another description of his enlightenment. The doors to the deathless have been opened. So the Buddhist life is one of celebration and overcoming of death. Because the Buddha overcame that addiction to identification. If you don't have an identity, there's nothing to die. A real exemplar in the Buddhist tradition of the joy of the spiritual life is a character called Milarepa. You might be familiar with him. He lived in the 11th century. He was born around, there are various accounts, 1025, 1040. He lived in Western Tibet, and his actual birth name was Topaga, which means in Tibetan, delightful to hear, because he had apparently had an amazing singing voice. And that's what we know of Milarepa. There's the collection of so-called 100,000 songs of Milarepa. It's a lot fewer than 100,000, but he was a yogi living in the mountains, occasionally coming down and teaching people, and he had nothing. He ate nettles. He lived on very little, and yet whenever people met him and said, "Look, come down and, you know, we'll feed you, and you can marry our daughters, and you can have our cattle, and we'll give you land," he would say, "Look, I have everything I need. Everything I need to be happy, I have here now." He lived in the beauty of the mountains, in the midst of nature, in complete contentment, in a life of pure joy. So let me just give you an example of one of his songs, where this comes through. So this is Milarepa. "I bow at the feet of the noble guru. By gathering merit, I've met such a lord. Because of the guru's prophecy, I have come here. This blissful castle in the wooded mountains of Monial. It is a land of grassy mountains with radiant flowers in the midst of many dancing trees. A land where langurs and monkeys play. A place where birds sing and myriads of songs. A land where bees fly gently about, where rainbows shine both day and night, where light rain falls in both summer and winter, where the mist billows in fall and spring. Within such a solitary place, for me, the yogi Milarepa, the luminous experience of meditation on the emptiness of mind feels so good. However many negative manifestations arise, it feels extremely good. When the highs and lows are intense, it feels even better still. My body, free of negative karma, feels good. When there's a myriad of disturbances, it feels extremely good. When fearsome appearances are intense, that feels even better still. He used to be kind of visited by demons and such like. Being free of afflictions, birth and death, feels good. When the demon savagery gets worse, it feels extremely good. When there's no sickness, it feels even better still. Suffering arises as bliss feels good. The dancing of running and jumping feels even better still. I could go on and on, but I'll leave Milarepa there. You get a sense of the movement of the heart that is part of faith that expresses itself in joy, the spontaneous joy. So this affective, this heart aspect of faith is described as the object, is lucid faith, as I mentioned. And the object of lucid faith, again, this is according to Zhuang Zhang, our Chinese friend, are qualities, the qualities in people. For example, appreciation of those who exemplify the truth. You know, when the Buddha, but just before he left his life of luxury, he was really inspired by seeing what's called a fourth sight. After seeing old age, sickness and death, he saw a man who exemplified peace, tranquility, someone who had gone forth into the life of a wandering mendicant. And the Buddha saw this man and saw the peaceful expression on his face in the midst of the hustle and bustle of this village, and faith arose in him. This effective aspect of faith is expressed through qualities. It's interesting that Ananda, the Buddha's right-hand man, Ananda, it wasn't the speech of the Buddha's that inspired him to don the robes, shave his head, join the Buddha's Sangha. He according to the Pali Canon, he joined the Buddha because of the wondrous brightness of his golden-hued body. It's like he saw this quality in the Buddha, and that just was like a magnet to him. Okay, the third of the three aspects of Shraddha is what I've described as the legs aspect. It's more technically called the volitional aspect. It's also called longing faith. And it's the active aspect of faith. That's what I mean by legs. It's actually what makes you actually get up and do something. So you've seen the how reasonable the truth is. You're attracted to it. Your heart reaches out to it. What do you do on the basis of those first two aspects of faith? You actually you align your life with it. You do something, and that's the beauty of the Dharma, is that it's empirical. It's eminently practical, the Dharma. So we encounter a truth, a Buddhist truth, and generally you can try it out for yourself. This is the word we used in the Tiratnavanda this morning. One of the descriptions of the Dharma is ahipassiko, by nature of an invitation. So that's all the Buddhist truths are like that. They're saying, look, this is the way Buddhism says it is. Try it out. See if it works. Test it in the lab of your own experience. So meditation, does it make your life better? Try it out. Generosity, being generous to more to people, does that have an impact on your happiness? Try it out. Mindfulness, day-to-day, minute-to-minute mindfulness. Try it out. Does it make a difference to your life? And of course, hopefully, it works. And that's what really gives you a foundation of confidence, trust. So it's not just the intuitive sense of what the ultimate new resonating with the ultimate beyond you. It's not just the reasonability of it. It's the fact that you've tried it out for yourself and it works. And the Buddha says, look, don't take my teachings simply because I say them. Try them out, see if they work. Develop your own trust and confidence. And of course, you know, we're in a predicament, aren't we, as kind of budding Buddhas, budding Bodhisattvas. We're on a path. We've still much to learn. We're training on the road to the truth. We're in that predicament. We are reaching out into the dark, if you like. And trust is needed for that. But of course, trust based on our experience, as I was saying. So we need to trust our minds. We need to trust the process, trust our own capacities. But of course, that requires an openness, and that requires or entails vulnerability and humility. So it's not necessarily an easy path. According to Zhuang Zhang again, the objects of longing faith, this volitional faith, are our capacities. And of course, starting with our own capacity, our own potential, that latent potential in our inmost being, that Buddhahood, bud, which is waiting to flower. And this is something not general and vague, it's intimate, it's personal, that in which we live and move and have our being. Sangharakshita, another quote from Sangharakshita, he says, Buddhist faith may be said to consist in rejoicing in the Buddha's full realization of his spiritual potential, as I was talking about earlier when I was talking about the joy of the Buddha's life. And then he goes on to say, and trusting that you yourself are capable of reaching the same goal. So in the threefold puja, we said, what the Buddha attained, I too can attain. What the Buddha achieved, I too can achieve. That is volitional faith, Shraddha. Now there is one more aspect. So that there are the three aspects of faith, cognitive, affective, volitional, or deep faith, lucid faith, longing faith, our head, heart, and legs, if you like. And previously we also looked at the intuitive dimension. It's an intuitive response. And there is one other aspect, which I don't have time to go in here, but Prajnanita will explore later today. And that is the imaginative response. So we have this other faculty called the imagination. You could describe imagination actually under the volitional perhaps. But that imagination as a faculty of self-transcendence, as imagination as a vehicle of the Dharma life, as it is described in some places, a vehicle that allows us to experience the truth, not just conceptually. But as I say, Prajnanita will explore that realm. Good. So that's enough from me. For the moment. So now let us break up into groups. And the sense of these groups, the opportunity that these groups offer is to discuss the content of what I've been talking about, maybe as an aid to focus, if you want to take the question of what is your experience of those three aspects of faith, of the head, the heart, and the legs aspects of faith. Can you think about your own experience of those three aspects of Shraddha? Okay, so we'll have about 20 minutes or so. Whenever you're ready, Prajnanita, we'll see you back here in about 21, 22 minutes.